The Nonviolent Peace Force is an unarmed, paid peacekeeping force seeking to resolve conflicts around the world. Officially organized in 2002, we are pleased to have one of the co-founders, Mel Duncan of Minnesota, on the phone with us now to tell us about the work of this organization and perhaps give us some thoughts on what's going on in Syria now. Mel Duncan, welcome to the Roadhouse.
Well, I'm happy to join you, Dick. Thank you.
Okay, Mel, before we get into some examples of what your organization has done and then maybe on to Syria for a bit, perhaps you can give us a brief sketch of your background and how this Nonviolent Peace Force became organized.
A group of us came together at a conference in The Hague in 1999, and that conference was called together to develop a series of action points to put an end to war during the coming century. And so some of us from various parts of the world who had experience doing unarmed civilian peacekeeping and protection, primarily on a volunteer and ad hoc basis over the previous 20 years, came together and really challenged each other. Was this the time and place in history to increase the scale and the scope and the international character and professionalism of unarmed civilian peacekeeping? And it was really from that conference in May of 1999 that we developed a proposal and then spent the next couple of years visiting with people in the most violent places in the world, learning from them what they were doing that was working, and what, if anything, they might need from a group of well-trained unarmed civilians. So we brought all that together to a convening event in India at the end of 2002. And at that time, 150 people from 49 countries and many organizations began Nonviolent Peace Force. And we've been sending peacekeepers to various areas of violent conflict for the last decade now.
And how are you funded, Mel?
About two-thirds of our budget comes from UN agencies, the UNICEF and the UN High Commission on Refugees primarily, also from a number of national governments, Belgium, Norway, Germany, and then about a third of our funding comes from individual donors. And that's so very important to make sure that we stay independent and that we are accountable to civil society. And so people listening from Grand Marais can become a part of this and help create Nonviolent Peace Force.
And we'll get to that in a little bit more, but I'll give you a plug for your website right now. It's Nonviolent Peace Force, all one word, .org. And anybody can go online there, learn a lot more about than we're going to have time to discuss, and make donations, correct?
Correct. And also see how else you can help.
Yeah, sure. You have paid workers. Now, these workers that go in are no longer necessarily, they're volunteers in a sense because they don't get paid enough, probably, but describe how they're trained and who they are and what they receive as in the way of remuneration.
You know, one of the most encouraging things of doing this work, Dick, has been to meet committed people from around the world who are ready and willing and capable to do this work. We presently have about 200 peacekeepers who are in the field, and they come from 40 different countries. We never lack for recruits.
Wow.
In fact, routinely we have 10 applicants for every person that we can choose. I think our median age right now is about 36. We don't take people under age 25, and our oldest person in the field has been 65. They come from a variety of backgrounds, lawyers, judges, teachers, activists, journalists, but people who have had a background and a commitment to working for peace, and more importantly, who have worked cross-culturally. We find that one of the ingredients for success for our peacekeepers is people who have worked in various cultures other than their own. Now, that doesn't mean they've traveled internationally, because that can be an expression of privilege. But it does mean they've crossed boundaries, perhaps in their own communities.
And you don't just take them raw and send them into some situation. You give them some training. Is that correct?
Yes.
And
yes,
what is that like?
They go through an intensive screening first, and then those who are selected take part, first of all, in a mission preparedness training that is very intense. That's usually in the areas where they will be serving. So our last training was in South Sudan, where people were living in tents and bathing in the river. And that is very hands-on, very intense, and focuses on not only conflict analysis and the methodologies of unarmed civilian peacekeeping, but also how to work as a team, how to listen, and also deep training on our three principles, which are nonviolence, nonpartisanship. We do not go into an area to pick sides. We go there to provide protection of civilians and work with local organizations on violence deterrence. And our third principle relates to that, the primacy of local actors. We don't bring in agendas. Conflicts are for local people to sort out and to solve. But what we can do is provide protection and help create the space so that those people can do their work and stay alive. Now, you asked me about pay, so let me answer that question, Dick.
Sure.
Our peacekeepers receive all their expenses, room, board, lodging, transportation, insurance, a home visit each year, and then typically receive an offshore stipend of $1,500 per month. That can't be spent on site, but instead is sent home. And people either save that or use that to support their families while they're serving.
And when they're in these countries, are they living separate or as a separate unit, or do they actually mingle in with the people they're working with?
No, our peacekeepers will live in the communities that are experiencing the violent conflict.
So what you're describing is primarily conflicts within countries. Am I correct? You're not dealing with, let's say, wars between countries.
That's correct, because most of the wars today are intrastate as opposed to between countries across national borders. Almost all of them happen within, and this has been a phenomenon really since the Cold War, that now most of the violent conflicts take place within a country.
And how do you get involved in a conflict? I mean, you can go around and tick off many of them around the world right now. You're not involved in all of them. How do you decide which ones to get into, and how do you get invited? Go ahead.
That's right. We only go at the invitation of local organizations and organizations that are committed to peace, reconciliation, and human rights. And then once we receive an invitation, we review, give it an initial review to see if there's an opportunity, a chance for us to be of service. And we present then that to our governing council, who then decides whether to give us a green light or not. If they decide that we can go ahead, then we will send an exploratory team that spends anywhere from 2 to 6 months in the area working with local groups and developing relationships, and then they bring back a report based upon 25 criteria that we've developed to look at whether unarmed civilian peacekeeping could work in that particular situation. Our governing council reviews that, and then once they approve it, we can start recruiting and raising the money to send the teams.
And obviously one of the things you're looking at is how dangerous is it going to be, I suppose.
Well, that's correct. We do assess whether our people can be safe, because and these are all relative terms, because they're living and working in areas of violent conflict. But can we protect ourselves? Are the combatants, for example, are we able to communicate with them? Because while they don't have to love us, we have to be able to communicate with all the parties to the conflict. Are those parties sensitive to international pressure? Conversely, do they have status within their organization for killing internationals? If that's true, that's probably not a place that we could work. Are there substantial local infrastructures for peace? So we look at all of those kinds of things before we make the final decision.
I do want to get your thoughts on Syria and whether or not you could possibly have a role there. But if you want to tell us about one example of where you've been either now or in the past and how it has worked, maybe you could do that if you would.
Okay, one quick example. We were in Sri Lanka, where there was a rampant use of child soldiers, where children were being kidnapped as early as age 8 sometimes and forced to join a military unit. A group of mothers came to us one day because their sons had been kidnapped the night before. We accompanied those mothers to the camp. This was, in this case, with the Tamil Tigers. And those mothers asked for their children back who had been abducted the night before. The young local commander said, "You go away. This is no longer your matter." Can you imagine, Dick, telling a mom whose kid was kidnapped the night before that this is no longer your matter? So we stayed, and those mothers were accompanied by a group of people from various parts of the world, from Germany, from Ghana, from Canada. And so they sent for their superiors. And over the course of the next day and a half, those children were released and went home with their mothers. This became routine, where we would routinely accompany mothers to retrieve their children and keep them from becoming child soldiers. Yeah. So that's one example of how this works. I was in Syria in May as part of an initial exploration to see if there are things that can be done. And I would really remind all of us that are listening tonight that there are alternatives between doing nothing and firing off cruise missiles. Secretary Kerry really put up a false dichotomy last week when he said these are our choices. There is a host of peacekeeping and peace-building options between those two poles, one of which is introducing unarmed civilian peacekeepers to not only protect civilians in Syria, but to work with the nonviolent civil society, which is active and well there and are being ignored by the international community. There are men and women who are leading efforts at reconciliation, establishing zones of peace, doing peace building across various lines, to provide a foundation for a sustainable peace. Most of them are in opposition to the government, but some of them are supporting the government. And they provide the common ground and the foundation for a lasting peace in Syria. They must be at the table when Geneva II is convened. Those seats at that table should not only be reserved for men with guns. They need to be reserved for those women, especially, who are doing the sustainable peace work that will make a lasting peace in Syria. And they're there, and they need and deserve our support.
How do you think that point of view can be presented to the world leaders? I mean, or is it being presented to the world leaders?
Well, we do our best, and it can be presented by everyone listening, by writing to Senator Franken and Senator Klobuchar and Representative Nolan, and saying not only accept the chemical weapons proposal and work with Russia, but also stop supporting any armed group and work with Russia for both the U.S. and Russia to put pressure on our allies and ourselves to quit arming those groups. Dick, I've been in a lot of conflict zones in my life. I've never seen more guns than when I was in Syria.
Really?
And there are people getting rich off of this, and that needs to stop.
Mm-hmm.
Russia and the U.S. can play a major role in setting a ceasefire, in setting humanitarian access so that food and clothing and lodging can get in to probably 2 million people now who are displaced, and also supporting the introduction of unarmed civilian peacekeepers. This is within our reach, and people should not just go quietly at this point, but let our senators and Representative Nolan know that there are alternatives, and this is a time to engage our moral imagination.
And this would be a situation where, if you were called upon, you could introduce some nonviolent, unarmed workers who, and as you put it, their presence tends to protect the innocent civilians between the warring parties.
That's right.
That's interesting. I mean, I think, you know, they maybe are more callous when they're dealing with their own citizens than they are with international citizens who come in and try to mediate a dispute.
That's right. You know, one of the principles, and this doesn't understate it, is people don't fight when the neighbors come over.
Right. Yep.
And so these are reasonable options. They have been tried and been shown effective in areas as widespread as Colombia, Guatemala, the Balkans, the Philippines, Sri Lanka, South Sudan, Kenya. There are many examples of this, and we need to be employing and developing this resource.
Well, Mel, I certainly appreciate everything you've said here tonight, and we appreciate the work you do, and I hope the world is listening as well as our listeners here on WTIP. I wish we had more time to talk to you. I appreciate very much your taking the time to give us your points of view and hopefully present a nonviolent option for what's going on over in Syria now. We wish you all the best, and thank you very much for being with us here on the Roadhouse.
Okay, thank you, Dick. It was good talking with you.